Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Election Day, Tuesday, the 4th of November. And what an appropriate guest to have today, the author of Election Day, An American Holiday in American History. Kate Kelly is our guest. Kate frequently writes and speaks about American history, and the book is just really interesting. She says when we go to voting booths across the country to cast our ballots, we rarely think of the rich heritage of Election Day. It has a history more complex than any other holiday. It combines the history of our voting practices and suffrage laws with a very wonderful story of how our forebears celebrated Election Day. So we're going to talk about how we have celebrated Election Day this hour of the program. And we gave you some of the questions from the Election Day quiz, which our guest has put together. Test how much you know about Election Days of the past. If you want to answer some of these Election Day questions, we'll give you all of them at about 10:20 today, and then you can answer every single one of them. We welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Some of you may do certain things yourselves to celebrate this as a holiday, so if you want to call with your stories about how you will prepare for and enjoy the evening election returns, we'd love to hear your stories. Hello, Kate. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I guess the first question is, why isn't this a holiday? We were talking with friends about this yesterday. It should be, in a way, so you don't have to worry about getting the food ready for tonight, and you can listen to the radio or watch television all day, and you can go vote and not have to worry if you might have to wait a little bit. Have there been attempts to make this a holiday?
There have been attempts, and of course there's current legislation to move the election day to actually to a weekend so that it might make it easier for people to actually go and vote. But this is one of those issues that's decided on a state-by-state basis, and actually in the New York area it is a state holiday, but I have to tell you all my friends and neighbors are off in the workplace today. It doesn't make any difference in terms of the actual handling of the day. It may make it a little easier for poll workers to be available and for state workers to vote, but most of us are just on a regular schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the trend that we're actually seeing that will make a big difference, particularly with the economy the way it is right now, you know, declaring a federal holiday is very expensive for small businesses, and I have a feeling what we're going to see is a greater trend toward this early voting method. And I think that's a wonderful solution because it means if you have a busy day on election day and are working all day, you could actually have voted several days in advance in a lot of communities. 30 states this year are actually trying some form of early voting. So that does hold a lot of promise and might solve the problem for us.
The problem is some of those waits, as you well know, are atrocious. They're 8 hours in some places. That's not acceptable.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
These states used to all vote on one day.
Right.
So that is amazing. What I think what we're seeing is that only a few office voting places have been open for this early voting, and probably what we'll see is more places are open for an early voting. But I think it's going to be fascinating to see what the statistics are in terms of voter turnout for today. I just think we're really, in 2004, only 55% of registered voters actually cast a ballot, and I think we're going to be way up from there, which is just so exciting.
Yes, it is. How did we pick Tuesday?
We picked Tuesday because it was decided upon in the time when they had to calculate that most people were Christians, and so the Sunday was the Sabbath, and they wanted people to be able to be at home on the Sabbath, and then Monday was the travel day, and so Tuesday was the logical day to vote. But having only one day as a voting day is actually somewhat unusual. It used to be that the polling places would be open over a period of a couple of days because traveling was difficult enough that people needed to have additional time to come in. Now, it would also be that the sheriff was the person who would actually, not, you know, kind of the Western sheriff, but that was the title of the person who ran the elections. And he might deem that, well, we're going to have 2 days of voting, and he might have intended to stay open until 3 o'clock, but if he decided to close the polls at 1 o'clock and people came in after that, that was just their tough luck. So there there wasn't a particularly official system where everything had to stay open. It was kind of like whatever the spirit of that particular person was however long the voting would take place.
You have wonderful stories of colonial times in which this really was a day of reunion. People had to take their horses quite a distance, I'm sure, some of them to vote, and they brought food and drink and had a lot of fun. It was getting to see your friends.
Exactly. It was getting to see your friends, and that was unusual when it was an agrarian community. And also, the women and children would come in and really enjoy the day. The women would be busy preparing some sort of noontime feast, and the men would get together and deal with all kinds of business. And it could be anything from trading cattle to settling a duel, whatever they felt. And the militia, if there was a local militia, they would often practice on that day. So there were all kinds of things you could take advantage of when everybody got together.
Mm-hmm. And then you move it ahead to 1840, people relishing the politics. There were a lot of parades in those days, massive barbecues, which I think is a great idea.
Exactly. But the thing that when I've been speaking on this topic, the thing everybody loves being reminded of is that the presidential candidates themselves were expected to run silent campaigns. They did not. It was considered vote begging, so they made no speeches on their own behalf. Especially during the colonial period, late 1700s, early 1800s, a friend might write a letter on their behalf, but there was absolutely no politicking done by the candidate themselves. The political party stepped in, and they would run these massive events with stump speakers. So there were plenty of people talking about the issues. It just wasn't the candidates themselves.
Oh, that's interesting. And what do we have today? We have, I think McCain is giving a speech today, and Obama is as well, right? They're not doing the heavy duty go from place to place, but...
Yes, and I think that was kind of a last-minute decision where both of them decided to stay out on the trail for a little bit longer. But yes, certainly what they do on the election day, I remember reading a contemporary report by someone who was at the polling place and wrote for their local newspaper when Abraham Lincoln came in to vote, just talking about... what he did when he showed up at the polling place. And certainly those moments are just so memorable. So we're looking forward to the fact that John McCain and Barack Obama might be able to take tomorrow off, because it has been a daunting schedule that they have had.
Do you think that it is simply because of the number of miles that they have to go that it is a much, much, much more daunting task than it was in 1840?
Well, I think the fact that the travel is possible is what makes the difference. But then you figure in the 1840s there was no very good way of getting the news out very quickly. So even if they did travel, the coverage of it wouldn't have been the same that we experience today. Today you basically could stay in a few places and get the same kind of media attention. But I think that they believe that it's really important to be out and meeting with people. And I keep hoping they're also out listening. I think that if there's a benefit to these travel, I'm sorry for the punishing it must be in terms of their time, but I hope that they're out listening to candidates, listening to the populace very carefully, because for them to hear how people are really feeling in a variety of states and living in a variety of circumstances is just really important for us going forward.
Mm-hmm. But punishing is really quite an apt word for this. What in 2 years, Kate? Two years. It's just, I don't know how any human being can do this.
Exactly. And I must say that even if we have to stand in line for 8 hours for voting, it's nothing compared to the time they've donated to their country in pursuit of representing us. So I think that's an important thing to remember. I mean, I think there are two things. If you do hit a really long line for voting, first of all, become an activist citizen and campaign for change for the following election. Now, I think Ohio is a state where they had a lot of problems, and it certainly sounds like they've done a great deal to remedy the problems that they had in 2004, and that's important. I think we all need to be citizen activists and say, hey, this isn't acceptable, because this is a privilege, but it's also our right. And so stepping out on that, but then also just remembering we do all need to vote. And sometimes when I give my talks, people say, oh, but my vote doesn't count, I live in a blue state, or my vote doesn't count, I live in a red state. And I think that it's really important to remember two things. First of all, we're not just voting for president. There are many, many local issues and local candidates that need our vote. So it's important to be there for those local issues. And also the fact that I think that the national candidates need a mandate. I think they need, regardless of what the Electoral College says, I think it's really important that whoever the winner is understands that they won by a landslide, or they barely squeaked by, and sure, they need to govern accordingly.
Right. A very good point. Do you do the same thing every presidential election season? Do you have a party? Do you do interviews every time, or what?
You know, I actually don't. I kind of reinvent myself every 4 years because the book, a lot of times I've done schools, and this year I just decided it was really important to address adults, and it's been so gratifying because, especially since this one has been going on for so long with the, you know, the Democratic rivalry, you know, being as heated as it was, people, it was kind of like friend against friend, and people really appreciated having a nonpartisan speaker come in, and they could address the election, and they could talk about issues that were worrying them, but they didn't have to stand up and be counted for one candidate or another. So I've done community groups and you know, different adult groups, and it's just been wonderful. In terms of my own election day, we'll be getting together with a few friends, and it isn't a particularly big occasion other than following it on the television news, but this year is one of those years that, first of all, you kind of do want to be with other people because it has been so emotionally heated, and we all do care so deeply about the future of the country. So we will be getting together with people tonight.
Great. You have to answer this question for me because I've been thinking about it ever since I asked it at the end of the last hour. One president, this is part of your quiz, one president was the first to be a golfer, the first to keep an automobile at the White House, and the last to keep a cow.
And would you like the answer right away, or shall we give the viewers a moment?
Let's give
the listeners a moment.
Let's give them a moment.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
All right. We'll do that. And if you want to try and answer that, you need to call right now. And we don't have a prize, but you can at least get the satisfaction of saying, I'm right, or I have something to learn. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Kate Kelly is our guest. Her book is Election Day, An American Holiday, An American History. And just a reminder that tonight, starting at 6, NPR will have election coverage for you. State and national races will be anchored by Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Debbie Elliott. And coverage of local and state races will be anchored by Ben Marins and Sean Johnson. This starts at 6, and my understanding is that it will go as long as need be so that you know exactly what happened. It could be as long as 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn. To your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this election day. It's finally here, huh? Kate Kelly is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls, Kate, with Jeff from Wausau. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
This is a real pleasure. I am calling to respond to the question about who was the golfer and who had, I was unaware that he might have had a cow, but I think it was William Howard Taft.
Absolutely.
Oh, right. Good job, Jeff. And that's a hard one. I wish we had a present to give you.
Yeah, well, you're my present.
Oh, Jeff. Great. You have a keen understanding of American history. Thank you. Happy Election Day, Jeff.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks. That's a great question. Howard Taft. I bet not too many people get the answer to that, Kate.
Well, exactly. And actually someone said, why do you think he had a cow? And I would expect it was for the very practical purpose that they still used it for. You know, I'm sure the White House kitchen put the cow to work is my thinking. But I don't know.
Oh. Well, it's not a bad idea to have a cow. I want to have a donkey sometime. So.
Yeah, exactly. Then it would be political. You'd have to have an elephant.
Yeah, that's true, but it would be hard to have one in your backyard. Yeah, I don't mean for political reasons. I just like donkeys now. One of these days. Thanks, Jeff, for your call. Paul from La Crosse is next. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I just finished reading Team of Rivals, and what I got from that book was that they did not travel. They did not campaign. It was considered unseemly for the candidate to leave his house. That you had surrogates. And I think this was 1860. They'd only had, you know, decent rail travel for about 20 years. And it was still very difficult to get to most of America. And they would stay at home, and they would have surrogates going out and giving stump speeches and riding the circuits and doing things like this to drum up supporters and all that kind of stuff. But the candidate would stay home. Lincoln stayed in Springfield, And when he voted in Springfield in 1860, that was the last time he voted there. Matter of fact, I mean, when he left to be president of the United States, he never went back. So it was a completely different time from what we have today. And they were, and now this is what I remember from the book. I mean, and I could be wrong, but it seemed, I'm not sure when it changed so that the candidate was expected to be out there on the traveling. I think it with improved rail service, with the automobile and the airplane, I think it became more feasible. But at that time, they were pretty sedentary.
Kate.
Yes, they were. And actually, around that time period, Stephen Douglas was very concerned in the 1850s about what was happening. And he did travel, but he realized he had to come up with an excuse. And so the excuse he came up with was that his mother lived in Clifton Springs, New York. And so he announced that he was actually on his way to visit her. And the Republicans got wind of this excuse, and they created a handbill to poke fun at him, but also put him in his place. And the handbill started out, "Little boy lost, you know, says he's on his way to meet his to see his mother. His mother is very concerned about him. He has not yet reached his mother, but he's been seen in New York, Philadelphia, and at the clam bake in Rhode Island." So they came up with a way of sort of pushing him back. And he was, you know, even though he did travel to campaign some, he did not start a trend. After that, they started doing a little bit of campaigning, but they were front porch campaigns where the candidate might step out on their own front porch and address a crowd, but they still didn't travel until we get to William Jennings Bryan in the late 1800s.
Hmm. Anything else, Paul?
No, that's about it. Enjoy the election.
Thanks. You too. Yeah, enjoy the day. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. There, of course, is, and we may be particularly aware of this today, a real dark side to voting as well, which you talk about in your book, where particularly black voters tricked and threatened and beaten and killed sometimes in an effort to deny them the right to vote. Also, women getting the right to vote in this country. It's hard to imagine. It's not all that long ago what a precious right it is and how people were denied in such brutal ways, Kate. Isn't it just brutal ways, the right to vote?
Exactly. No, being lynched. I mean, in the South, the white voters would leave signs of blood and clippings of hair to make it look like somebody was killed on their way to the polls to try to discourage voters from going. You know, there were open threats. And, you know, the Voting Rights Act, that guaranteed the right to vote for African Americans was only passed 43 years ago. And that was really the first time that it was really seriously safeguarded throughout our country, and that is an unbelievable date to think of being that close. I also read an interesting story about in the 1920s, you know, women were given the right to vote in 1920, and a newspaper from the New York area from that time period reported that, yeah, and of course it was not accurate, but it was sort of like their take on it, and they said that every woman in New York who didn't have the Spanish flu seem to have gone out to vote that day. So I think that they had a good turnout in New York, but they said in the South, women just didn't go to the polls. It was just not anything that they were interested in, and they theoretically did not show up. Now, I will also add to that that in the West, starting in Wyoming in 1869, they gave the right to women to vote for local and state elections. So from 1869 on, and then by 1914, every state in the West except for New Mexico gave women the right to vote for these local and state elections. So it was a little earlier than the 1920 date, but still not when white men got the vote at all.
Mm-hmm. There are certain states, Wisconsin is one of them, which has a fine record of great participation in elections. Can you talk a little bit about that, why some states have this strong tradition, other states don't have a real strong tradition, and why everybody is predicting a huge voter turnout today?
Well, I think that the turnout today is predicted just partly because the economy, everyone cares deeply about what's happening to the economy because it's going to affect us all. But I think earlier than that, certainly the excitement of Barack Obama and the youth vote and the use of text messaging and the internet and that sort of thing really got a new base going in terms of registration. You know, the young people traditionally don't tend to vote in the numbers that you might expect, even though they've registered. So it will really be interesting when they break it down by demographics to see whether there was a big difference in the youth voter today and whether or not it makes a difference. In terms of the states and their participation, I think that perhaps the West and Wisconsin included in that, just because of the way it was settled and you know, sort of moving into that area in order to build up something for yourself, probably built an activism in the community that maybe didn't exist in the same way in the East. I grew up in Colorado, and I feel the same thing you do. You just always participated in your community, and I remember my father being proud to pay his taxes because that was what gave us a fire department and paved our roads, and that was what we were raised with, was that, you know, that the government needed, you know, some money from us for those types of things, and it was important to pay up and also to participate. So I think it's that kind of background that makes states more responsive, and, you know, the citizens in the state more responsive.
And give us a little bit of a history when it comes to youth vote. From what I've read, there will be a greater turnout this election, but there are also reports that it could be disappointing. What is the story with young people? Why don't they go to the polls in huge numbers? It's a big thing to be able to get the right to vote.
Well, it is a big thing, and I have a college-age daughter who has voted absentee, but she said, you know, young people don't like to have to do something on a specific date. And I thought, well, you know, maybe that's it. There's also a little bit of confusion in the sense that if you're a college student and you're going to college someplace away from your home community, you may have registered as a, you know, late senior in high school and now you've moved. And, of course, the Supreme Court has ruled that you can vote, you know, you can re-register and vote in your college community. But I do think that there's less tie to a college community, and you may not know the issues in the same way. So I think all those factors feed into it. But certainly, you know, 1971 was the date that the 18-year-old was given the right to vote, and certainly at a time like that with the Vietnam War and young people going off to the service, it meant that people really did want to have the right to vote. And one would hope that we'll see a new level of activism this year because it is really important that we all participate.
We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we're pleased to have with us the author of Election Day, an American Holiday in American History. Kate Kelly is our guest and includes all kinds of information about the history of our democratic process, how we have voted through the years, and also some, oh, we have to talk about those, some of the funny election bet payoffs. We haven't done election bets in my house yet. We'll have to do that later today. But some of the very funny things that people had to do because they lost their bet. And we're also entertaining calls from you. It'd be nice to get a sampling of how voter turnout is going around the state today, how you celebrate. Do you have certain rituals that you follow every presidential election? Do you have the same people over? Do you watch by yourself? Do you become obsessed now with the internet or with television coverage, with radio coverage? What do you do with this day? We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. And we also have an email that you can go to. That's talk@WPR.org. Here's another one of Kate's questions. Election day questions. So try and answer this. No prize, but you can just appear to be incredibly smart on the radio. In 1908, the Democratic Convention was held in Denver in July. What did they bring in and guard so that the conventioners could see it? That's a great question, Kate.
It's a hard one.
It is a very hard one. I don't know if we'll get an answer to this, but we'll put it out there. If we don't by 11, then we'll have you answer the question. Talk about, you do in the book, these are funny, some of the election payoffs when people lost their bets.
Well, I think of two particular stories. One was a New York-oriented story where the person whose candidate didn't win said he would roll an apple across the Brooklyn Bridge with using his nose. And so that was one wager. And then in the West, they tended to wager things like wood chopping. And in one particular community, the winner said that they would chop a cord of wood and stack it neatly on the, you know, village green if, you know, whichever candidate that they were supporting lost. So that the loser was the one who had to do the chopping.
Let's go to Debbie from Delafield. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment was just that when I was growing up, I don't remember there being a whole lot of political conversation happening in our home. And I think that just it just made it more of a of not knowing what I was voting for, not what knowing what I was supposed to be looking for, just that type of a thing happening in my home. And so it just it carried over for a long time, I think.
And how is it now? Is it different now for you? Have you changed?
Oh, it's different now only because my husband is so very intelligent, and we talk about some stuff, and stuff we agree on and some stuff we don't agree on. And so it has changed, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But only because I married into it a little more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my comment.
Well, I think that's a really important point. If you're surrounded by it and following the various issues, it's like all the local things that we need to vote on. We have to make a little effort to find out what some of the amendments and that sort of thing we're voting. Usually we're aware of the candidates that are local because they've done their campaigning. But some of the other issues, we need to put our nose in the newspaper or listen to the radio and make sure we've paid attention to what it is so that we're prepared when we go in. So you're right. A level of education makes us a more sophisticated voter on those things.
Mm-hmm. And what about if you've talked about politics? Is this when you're growing up? Is it a strong indication that you're going to become a voter and a lifelong voter?
Well, I think that the main thing that when I ask people for memorable voting experiences, the one thing people do talk about is either taking their own children with them or being a child and taken with them for the voting process. And I do think that's great. You know, in New York, we still use those big lever machines with the curtains. And, of course, those are tailor-made for being enchanting to a child.
Yes.
I think it's a little harder with the different kinds of methods we're using today because you need to process things quickly and you need to pay attention to what you're doing. So it's not quite the same thing as letting your child stand beside you and pull, you know, you flip the levers and then they do the big lever at the end of the process. But I still think it's important to talk to kids about, and I remember when my kids were in school, I would always make the point to tell them that I was going to vote that day because I wanted them to know that no matter what, I was taking the time, even if they weren't going with me. So I think just making sure that your children know that you're voting and you're participating in the process is very important. And it does make a difference in terms of lifelong commitment. I think that, you know, in my family, it simply wasn't acceptable to not vote for anything. I mean, you know, whether it was school budget or presidential election, you have to vote. It's just that important. If we're given an opinion, we have to make sure we voice it.
Thanks, Debbie, so much for your call. Let's go to Don next from Kenosha. Hi, Don.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
I wanted to comment a little bit on your earlier, the information about President Taft having the last dairy at the White House, the dairy barn at the White House, and that was his cow was called Pauline Wayne, and she was a Kenosha County cow.
Oh no! Oh really?
Fact, yes.
That is great. How did you happen to know that?
Well, I'm kind of a local historian and a retired newspaper writer, and I wrote a story about Pauline Wayne. The interesting thing is, the President Taft had a cow, a prize cow called Mooley, and Mooley died, and then Senator Stevenson from Wisconsin was a friend of the president, a colleague, and he offered the prize dairy cow from his herd in Kenosha County. He had a dairy herd in Kenosha County, and that was Pauline Wayne. She was a national champion in terms of productivity. And so Pauline Wayne went off to Washington, D.C., and remained there several years. During the campaign that followed, the president was supposed to open the National Dairy Conference in Milwaukee. But through a scheduling conflict, he also was simultaneously scheduled in a mistake in Washington State and could not be in both places at the same time. And so to stand in for him, he sent the Wisconsin cow to the National Dairy Conference, and the cow was sort of the hit of that particular event.
Oh, my goodness, that is a great story.
Yeah. It's a fun story.
Can you send us the article somehow, Don, and we'll get it to Kate? I'm sure she'd like to have it.
You bet.
Okay.
That'd be wonderful.
I will do that.
Great. Thank you. And then we'll send it along to you.
It adds a new level of credibility to that quiz question, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Thank you, Don, very much for your call. Tom is next from Platteville. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm sitting out here in front of the voting place at the university here.
Oh.
Shuttling students to and from the voting area. And I heard you talking, and I think one of the reasons Wisconsin has a high voting turnout is like other states in the Midwest that has same-day registration where they don't put up any hurdles, they don't put up any roadblocks to voting. They've historically made it very easy to vote here in Wisconsin compared to regions like the South, which used to go out of their way to keep voting turnout and suppress voters. So that's why I think one of the reasons we have a high voting turnout.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Tell us how the lines are in Platteville. Are they long today?
Not bad at all. I voted 2 weeks ago, and I think a lot of other people have done that. So there's no big lines at all here.
So today
That's
should be
great.
Easier.
And so you've got a lot of students going to vote too, right?
Yes. I've got a couple in the van right now that I'm taking because they can't vote at the campus because their voting place is in a different area in town. So I'm taking them there.
That's wonderful. Well, and I think that does solve a problem because college students, it takes a little bit of time to get acclimated. So if they can do it on the same day registration method, that is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much for the call. And let's go to Cindy from Milwaukee. Hi, Cindy.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
A couple of things. I live on the east side, so I vote where a lot of students vote. And I was there about 7:30. There was a very long line of young people there waiting to vote. And then we are going to be serving at a free meal site tonight, and our day to do that always falls on the first Tuesday of the month, so we're often there after voting. And it's an interesting to get the feel for what that population of people that are the guests are thinking about the election. And some are not able to vote if they don't have an address. But most of them are people who are able to vote but are needing to have a free meal for, financial reasons. So it's an interesting
way to spend this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. It's great to get the feedback and sort of a sense of the area in a way that you wouldn't otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just that's what we have been doing the past few years on election night.
Thanks very much, Cindy.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Just a reminder, that question is still out there. We haven't had any answers yet to that. 1908 Democratic Convention held in Denver in July. What did they bring in and guard so that the conventioners could see it?
And I can give a kind of a hint, which was one of the reasons that Denver so desperately wanted the convention was because people didn't really, it was more difficult to travel then, and people hadn't really been west. So they looked at this as an opportunity to open the west so that people would realize they were part of the country, too. And there was one newspaper article that talked about the fact that if people could come there for the convention, maybe they would realize you didn't have to have two pistols to go downtown in Denver. So it was truly, they did come there, and the building was beautiful, and it was an opportunity to kind of showcase the West in a way that it hadn't been showcased before, which was very nice. So the hint there is then what else might they have been wanting to really show off when people came to Colorado?
Hmm. All right. There's a hint. Give us a call if you know the answer. 800-486-8655. We won't give this as a question, a quiz, but people, of course, remember when the press went with the wrong results, the Chicago Tribune in 1948, saying that Harry Truman had lost, Dewey wins the election. Has that happened many other times, if ever, in the American presidential election, Kate?
Well, I think that was such a bad experience that they definitely have been very cautious since that time. The main thing is people, they have now settled on the fact that the news people won't report anything until the polls close in each area, that until your polls close in Wisconsin, they won't announce anything. And so that's one of the things that they're doing to make sure that there's no guesstimate that goes out in advance of the news, because nobody wants that sort of information. I will say, though, that there were now obviously the eastern states will begin to report before California has finished voting. And when I did my research for the book, there was actually a precedent for that, which was that there was no standard election day in the early 1800s. And so I would be reading a story about, you know, go to the polls. In this case, it was a Rhode Island newspaper talking about being sure to go out and vote. And every other state and the way they were casting their electoral votes was actually reported in that newspaper. And yet on the other side of the page, they were telling you to be sure to go and vote for the, you know, the in the presidential election. So other state, you know, in other words, there is a precedent for the fact that you may know how other states are voting even before you've actually had a chance to vote.
Right. Let's go to Walt from Eagle River. Hi, Walt.
Hi, Kathleen and Kate. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick sidelight on the Lincoln discussion earlier. My recollection is that while he did indeed vote in Springfield in 1860, he didn't cast a vote for himself, or neither for any candidate in the presidential part of the election. But the main reason I wanted to call is, again, speaking of historically, sort of the deference or the way people approached the position of presidency, it was really strongly considered that it was the job seeking the man, not the man seeking the job. And I think what illustrates that perhaps best is I think it was FDR was the first candidate to go to a convention and accept the nomination in person. I think before that it was always done by telephone or telegram.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And your point about the job seeking the man was true, and I think the John Adams story depicts that it was actually a burden that he didn't want and that sort of thing. So you're absolutely right. It was not, it was considered an obligation. And, of course, you look at the Founding Fathers, and they felt a lot of responsibility. It wasn't like they did a couple of years of, you know, governmental effort or anything. I mean, they really devoted their lives to pulling this country together in that way. So that's a very good point. And you're absolutely right about, I think the candidates for a long time didn't vote for themselves, and indeed the FDR story is absolutely true. It was the first time that he showed up, and he showed up because there was concern about his health. So even though the press never openly reported on his polio or anything, at least by him being there, it was stepping forward and saying, I'm perfectly healthy and here I am to accept the nomination.
Why wouldn't you vote for yourself? That's fairly commonplace. That's something, if any of us have run for office in high school or whatever, we always vote for ourselves.
Well, I think it went to the idea of decency and responsibility and that sort of thing. Don't you think so? I mean, it was a different time.
Thanks. Unless you had something else, Walt.
That's it. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have a couple people who are waiting to respond to what it was that was guarded at the convention in Denver in 1908, a Democratic convention. We'll get some of your possible answers, possible correct answers in a moment. Kate Kelly, our guest, Election Day, an American holiday in American history, is what we're talking about here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kate Kelly, our guest on this Election Day, and let's go next to Peter from Milwaukee. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I'm here to try to answer the 1908 question.
Good. Okay.
I'm not sure if this is right, but they, I guess Mayor Spear had just finished a city fountain, and I'm not sure if it was mobile, so I'm not sure if they brought it in to guard at the convention, but I know it was some fancy fountain that they had.
Huh. Okay.
That's a really good guess, but it's not the one I was thinking of, so but thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, yeah, thanks very much. Let's try another one. Sue from Thorpe. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm guessing that it would be a steer, possibly.
Well, that's actually a really good guess, and it is not what I was thinking of, but that is a very good guess, because you would think, as part of the spirit of the West, that might have fit.
Right.
Okay,
Sue.
Right,
thank you. Thanks. Gail from Madison. Hi.
Hi there. I think that it's probably a bison that they had on display.
Oh, that's a really good idea, too, but that's not the one I read about. So.
All right, thanks. Oh, all the things they could have had, right?
Yes, exactly. It would have been a very good display.
Right, right. Let's go to Tony on another subject from Mount Horeb. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
Or my comments. See, the front porch campaign must have persisted at least till the 1920s in that we saw Harding's house in Marion, Ohio, and I think he may have been the last to do a front porch campaign. And the other comment I had was, on C-SPAN Sunday night on their Q&A program. They had an author with the title of a book, How Stupid Are We? Although ignorant may be a better word. But he claimed that only 2 out of 5 voters knew that there were 3 branches of government and could name them.
Mm.
Any comments on that?
Well, that's frightening, and one hopes not. One hopes that the great thing about the Internet and the radio and the television and that sort of thing is we all have so many avenues for paying attention to these things that we hope it will increase our level of knowledge. But that is not a very good statistic to have there.
No, it sure is not.
That was the author's hope, that this would stir people to get more informed, and that being the basis of a democracy, et cetera. But anyway, the Harding thing was interesting. It has a nice little Victorian house there in Marion, Ohio.
Hmm.
I recommend that site,
and
as well as the other Ohio presidential sites. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. You hear things like that, surveys of students in high school and college students on that subject and others, and you think something may be off. I'm wondering if you write about that and talk about that at all when you visit schools. Do we need more civics education, do you think? Do we need more mock elections and units on the vote in high school classes or earlier than high school, Kate?
Well, I think that those things all help and contribute to it. I must say that I think the family really is important in terms of paying attention to those things, because you know what a classroom is like. Some of the kids pay attention, and some of the kids, you know, just are not getting it on the same level. So I think that family participation in the voting process and talking a little bit about it, which was a point one of your callers made earlier, is probably the most important basis so that people realize that they really do make a difference. And, you know, that's the wonderful thing about having an African-American candidate and a female candidate, you know, the female for the second time, is it does give it that feeling of possibility. And I think if all of us think about the fact that, wow, this might be me or this might be my child, it gives us an investment in teaching our families about the importance of the process, because, you know, they realize, wow, my kid could grow up and be president. And that gives us more of a vested interest in it.
Tony, thanks so much for your call. Mark is next from La Crosse. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hello, Mark.
I would just had a response out regarding your question at the Denver convention.
Sure.
I was wondering, could it possibly be the pistols from the Aaron Burr and Duel?
No, that wasn't it either, but that's another good guess.
Thanks, Mark.
I mean, you'll tell me when I can put it out.
Yeah, I will. We'll take one more, and then actually, we got 2 interesting ones, and then we'll say, okay, give us the answer. Dave is next. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Hi.
I thought I'd just hazard a guess. Was it the Golden Spike?
Oh, that's another really good guess. You guys have really done your Western history. It is not that, but that would have been another thing they should have had on them. They put together a whole virtual museum that they could have had in 1908.
Right, yeah, they could have had a heck of a display of all kinds of things. One more and then give us the answer. Jim is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
My guess is the Constitution of the United States.
Hmm.
And, you know, I actually have had that response before when I've done a speaking in front of a group. So that's another good guess, another thing for our virtual museum.
Right. And nobody has the right answer. But they were all wonderful guesses. And the answer is what?
And the answer is snow. And what was interesting was they used rail cars to bring the snow down from the Rocky Mountains. And they put a fencing around it. And the police stood around. And if you were from Denver, you were not allowed to play in the snow, but if you were for any place else, you could step in. And so the description involves people in Panama hats and summer suits and everything, rolling up snowballs and you know, playing with the snow, because it was very exciting to. And of course, this was July, so it was all the more remarkable that the snow could be brought down in quantities enough that it didn't melt away right away.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing about the answers that you got were from all these people was it really does portray a picture of the West, because those were the things that were happening there. So it was wonderful to hear from everybody.
Right, yeah. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Let's go to Barbara from Ironwood next. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to comment. I was listening earlier and talking about how you prepare for an election or if you do your homework to know the issues. And I recently moved from California to Michigan, and I was very surprised to find out that I don't receive a sample ballot in the mail in Michigan. in California, we received a sample ballot, which sometimes I would find out about an issue from the sample ballot, knowing that I was going to have to vote on something that was a rural or a local item, and it would make me prepare for that vote. And here, I don't get anything in the mail, and so sometimes I'm surprised when I go to vote that there is something on the ballot that I wasn't prepared to vote on. So I just wanted to make that comment and wondered if you knew why there's those differences, why we don't have sample ballots in all states.
Good question.
That is a really good question. And, of course, all of this is because everything is decided on a state-by-state and a community-by-community basis. Now, in my area, the League of Women Voters tends to prepare something, but if we don't get that in the mail, there's usually something in our newspaper or discussed on local radio where they'll go through some of the issues. Now, I know in Colorado they have one particular community has 20 ballot issues. So it's really important in those areas that people read up on them so that you go in and have a checklist of how you intend to vote, because there are enough local things that to go in and read about them, you know, 20 different items on Election Day would be extremely time-consuming.
Yeah, there should be. Newspapers used to print the day before the election very, very complete voting guides, I think. And now they are doing endorsements a lot earlier, so it's more difficult. But there ought to be a place. There ought to be a place where everybody knows exactly what's on the ballot, and just there so you could be informed. Thanks, Barbara, so much for the call. Rob is next from Viroqua. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. I was just calling to comment about somebody earlier said something about that their family didn't talk much about the voting. And we're in the same kind of family. I mean, my folks always faithfully voted. But I think a lot of why I'm really into the politics now is because when I was in school, we had a lot of good government classes about the election, how important it is. And also, I was on the debate team for the FFA, and that is probably what sparked me the most of anything, is being on the debate team and getting into politics, you know.
I'm sure, yes.
Yeah, that's
and I do
really
have another
great
little funny story. When I was about 5 or 6, my folks must have been out of town, and I was at my uncle's house on the farm, and they lived in the country, so we had to go to the local town shop to vote. And here I thought we were going to the bathroom, but we went behind the curtain, and here all my uncle did was scratch on a sheet of paper. I thought we were just going to the bathroom.
That is good.
That's a very funny memory. Wes is next from Madison. Hi, Wes.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question for your guest about the history of voter fraud in America.
Mm-hmm.
If there were any notable election days that were someone tried to control, that there was, especially with what we've just watched earlier this year in Zimbabwe, if anything comparable has ever happened in America, or if there's any kind of good story attached to that or anything like that.
Well, voter fraud is almost always local, and there certainly has been voter fraud, everything from sometimes they would, you know, in the mid-19th century, they would pen up immigrants and then march them off to the polling place to get them to vote however they, you know, the group that was holding them wanted them to vote. They used to insert ballots. They would hand out paper ballots, but inside it would be additional tissue ballots, and they would, the election inspector would know that these were being seeded into the ballot box, and he would give the box a little shake before he opened it, and they would be called self-rising ballots because a lot of additional votes would be cast for someone. You know, when I've given my speeches, I've heard from poll watchers from the 1960s in Chicago where they were basically, they were poll watchers, but they were told they were not allowed to say anything, even if they saw abuse. But most of those stories are local, and generally following that, there's some level of community activism that helps right it. Because I do believe that we basically have a fair and honest system, and for every time there's abuse, something comes out that corrects that abuse. Like, there's a lot about whether or not these electronic machines are going to be great. And just like our home computers sometimes crash, well, these computers are going to sometimes crash, but somebody's going to come up with a fix for them so that they'll be okay and they'll be safe and it will be a secure method of voting. Because I think that overall we're a people who care about the ballot box and want a fair and honest system. So, yes, people are going to rig the system, but then there are going to be other people who come along and figure out a way that that particular game can't be played anymore.
And thank you, Wes, so much for your call. Well, Kate, you were a fabulous guest to have on today. Thank you so much. It was great fun.
A total pleasure, and you have given a gift to me. I loved hearing from everybody. That was wonderful.
Great. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
You're a fabulous audience. See, there you go. There you go again. Everybody complimenting you for being so involved, and you are. Thanks. Happy Election Day, everybody. Kate's book is Election Day, an American Holiday in American History. It is available in paperback and published by Universe. And we wish you the happiest of Election Days. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the results. Isn't that something? After all these years it's been, we'll be talking about the results. And tonight, you'll hear the results come in on the Ideas Network. Starting at 6 p.m., the Ideas Network stations and streams, and also WHRM in Wausau, carrying live election coverage, NPR's coverage of national races and the important state and congressional races, will be anchored by Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Debbie Elliott. Wisconsin Public Radio's coverage of local and state races, anchored by Ben Marins and Sean Johnson. And again, that starts at 6 o'clock tonight. Indications are that it will go late, might go as late as 2 in the morning. We'll just see what happens this evening. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Tretter for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And I'm going to go vote. So until tomorrow, everybody, have a lovely day. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Much more interesting conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.